Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today we're doing something a little bit different, but definitely one I know many of our investors and listeners are super excited about, and that's actually speaking to one of our own, an active trader. Lucio Conti is a former accountant who lives in Sydney South. He trades domestic and international stocks and recently options also, and he's very kindly offered to spend his Friday afternoon with us, talking us through his process as a trader. Lucio, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Gemma. I'm a big fan of your podcast, so it's good to see you in real life.
That's really kind.
I'll just give you a quick rundown of myself. Mid-50s, I won't give away too much. Married with a daughter. I worked mainly in corporate accounting for about 25 years. My education, a lot of people think you need to be educated, so I just see what I've been through. I did commerce at university. And one of the things that was really exciting, we had to do a project on a company. And so we had to go down to the ASX. And those days, it was the Melbourne ASX. So it was all the open call and the chalkies. It was very, very interesting. I think I got the bug from that. So later on, and then I decided to study a bit further. So I did the postgrad in applied finance, which covers more securities law, trading, market economics, more focus. Because the basic uni training is not enough to be a trader. And I've got to stress, you know, if you understand it, does it still make you a good trader? There's a lot of emotion involved. also, then I was really interested in the tech space, so I did a postgrad in IT, so I've been fairly busy. So I really enjoyed watching the financial markets. I really started investing. It was interesting doing this exercise because I went through, and I've never done it before, sat down. It was almost like a eulogy. And I realised when I was at university, I started buying government bonds to get some very good interest rate. Those days, it's probably about 10-12%. Not like yesterday, 1.5%. And then I really started investing in shares probably in the early 90s was my first go. So
that's amazing. I think your determination to have a really deep understanding of things before you get started is amazing, because many of us don't start that way. We dip a toe in the water with no knowledge whatsoever and learn on the go. So that's really a brilliant start, particularly the technology side. That's fascinating. So tell us a little bit about your portfolio. Tell us about what you like to buy, how your affairs are structured.
Well, first of all, the structure. I started, while I was working as an accountant, I started small, and my wife is in childcare, and she was earning less than me, so I did a lot of it in her name. So that went on for many, many years, and then in 2009, I decided to do full-time. So I gave up work as a CFO of a company, and started invest. So it's 10 years this year, actually, 10-year anniversary. And so then I'm doing it more in my name. I know it's not perfect. I think maybe the next couple of years I should be transitioning to a super structure. Mm-hmm. But then what I don't like about super is they keep playing with the rules and don't like that. So now it's outside super. But the good news is my daughter just turned 18. So I said, happy birthday. Here's your NAB Trade account.
I tell you, that's a very generous birthday present for your 18. That's cool.
We've got a good deal, she says. She gets all the dividends, she gets all the gains, and I'm underwriting all the losses. So.
That's an impressive setup for her, that she's doing very well. So 2009 for starting, that is, you get 10 out of 10 for timing.
Well, I think 2009 was when the GFC was on. Mm. And I tend to be a contrarian, and people think 2009 was a bad year, but I said, in a bad year, you get ANZ for $11, mm-hmm. you get Macquarie for $15, mm-hmm. you get CBA for $23. Mm-hmm. Is that a bad year? You just needed the internal fortitude to hold on. And, you know, benefit of hindsight, it came good.
I think that's so powerful. So I was also around in 2009 and did quite a bit of buying in 2009. It was nerve-wracking, but my goodness, wasn't it a lovely time? Yeah, so as a year to go, do you know what? I'm in this for real. That's very impressive. So you invest outside superannuation, which is interesting. There's a huge tax benefits to super, but you're not fully retired yet. You haven't hit that magical age where it's all tax-free anyway. So, okay, tell me a bit about the portfolio. What do you have? What do you like to buy?
That's an interesting question. When you pose this question, I've never actually sat down and looked at it because I'm always too busy. And it was very insightful. And I realised my top... Well, first of all, let me say my portfolio changes depending on the theme at the moment. If you'd have asked this 6 months ago or 12 months ago, it would be quite different. The current thematic I see now is, you've got a very low Australian dollar, which means favoured, US-based earning companies, and low interest rates. So that's sort of shaped what I've been investing in. And basically, my top 13 companies makes up 80% of the value, which surprised me when I sat down and calculated. Not that diversified. I've probably got too much in the way of financials, but then if I just explain that when we had the big dip back in December, I started using options. And again, I had training wheels on. And what I decided to do when things were really bad, I thought, well, things make it better like 2009. So what I did, I started buying a whole lot of call options, which means the right to buy at a certain price. So you fix the price. I almost call it, buy now, pay later.
Very popular at the moment. Yeah.
And so I did that with things like Macquarie Bank, ASX. I mean, ASX at the time was around $57. And I bought an option to buy it at 58 and out to February. And I thought, well, by the time February comes along, I'll know the results and I can decide whether to exercise the option or to sell, which means buy the shares or just sell the options at a profit. As we know, the benefit of hindsight, everything turned around and I did pretty well. Now, and a lot of those I'm still holding on to, I've sold some, and so those gains are still sitting there unrealised, many of the gains. Some of the other ones are like financials, mainly for the dividends. The reason I like banks like Macquarie is they've got the foreign earnings, so they get the benefit of any, as the Aussie dollar goes down, those earnings are worth more, which is great, and they also paid a big dividend. And what I like about their dividend goes into next year, which means it's more of a tax planning thing. So next year's set up quite early. I also hold a lot of fintechs, the Australian Stock Exchange, which I love. I mean, it's a great business. I'll just tell a little story on that. This is how I see it. I'm really a value investor and more of a fundamentalist. And in December, when things were going really bad, on a daily basis, I'd be looking at the ASX trading volumes. They report it every day. And I noticed that the volumes dropped 20% on the previous year. So I'm thinking, well, the volumes are going up and the share price is going down. No one's looking at the fundamentals. So that's why I decided to take out the option to buy it at a lower price and lock in the price into the future. And that worked very nicely. And I'm still sitting on the gains in that one. Another company I like is Iress. Obviously, I use the product with NabTrade. It's part of NabTrade and it's also part of Viewpoint, which is a great product. If you love the product, love the company. So, again, where the opportunity happened there is the ASX decided to sell their shareholding in Iress. Now, nobody knows why, but all of a sudden the Iress share price has dropped dramatically and I used the opportunity to buy, and that's why I bought those and bought quite a... And they're also come dividend as well, so why not? A bit of a bonus. Then I'm also holding some other stocks, which quite diversifies from financials. I'm holding a whole lot of agricultural stocks because I believe the lower dollar will mean a lot of those hard assets will be worth more, and the commodities they're selling are worth more in US dollars. Then there's some small things. Another interesting one I bought just recently is, as I tend to be a contrarian, there's a whole lot of car dealerships that are listed. Things like, if you want to mention, there's like AP Eagers, Auto AHG, and ASG. Now, you look at the chart, they're like a five-year low. And the story there was, house prices are down. People's houses are worth less. They're not buying cars. And so I picked them up quite cheap, and now they've started to merge, and there's a bit of takeover activity, and they've bounced. So, again, that was another good move. Again, I never had those 3 months ago, but I suppose that dip in value is what attracted me. And so they're part of my portfolio. Again, that may change in the next 6 months, and it's time to take profits on that and so go into something else, whatever's next.
That's absolutely fascinating. The way you've structured it and the way you are willing to pursue opportunities is really interesting. When we talk to different people, some people have very fixed process and a very limited number of things they're willing to look at. Yours is more thematic and broader.
Yeah, I've also got, I forgot to mention, I've got a smallish holding in overseas stocks. Again, I was always very keen on Apple as a company. And when they had the big dip, you know, they went from about $230 last year down to about $140-odd, and I bought into Apple. And at that time, the Aussie dollar was almost about 78, whereas now it's probably a bit more expensive. So, and I've also got a small holding in some Hong Kong-based companies, Tencent.
I was going to say, so you've got the American tech stocks. You're getting into the Asian tech stocks as well?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so one thing that you've mentioned, so you've retired, for want of a better term. No? This is your new line of work?
Yes, that's it. Yes, yep. Very good.
But you require the income from your portfolio,
yes,
to meet your living expenses.
Yeah, I didn't mention now my wife's gone back to work because our daughter's now. So I was a stay-at-home dad for a long time, which I absolutely loved. And the important thing is, I can talk about some later, it's a real lifestyle choice. You get to stay-at-home dad, fantastic. My wife's gone back to work for the break. And, you know, I love being a dad at home. And now she's 18 and things have changed again.
So your portfolio needs to meet a lot of needs, right? So it has to meet that income need for your family.
Yeah, maybe I didn't mention that mix of stocks that I mentioned, there's part growth and there's part dividend. So there's a mixture of the capital gains on selling options and growth in companies. So I'm taking capital gains and I'm also taking dividends. And together that makes up the income.
Okay, perfect. Yes, so it's just interesting for people to understand.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure, sure. Whereas, so basically it's a living, it's a job. And I take it pretty seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us a bit about your process now. So we understand what you hold and that moves pretty actively, which is pretty cool. Tell us about the process. How do you do your research? How do you get started?
Again, that's an interesting question because I never actually... Again, it's very intuitive because I've been doing it for so long. Okay, I suppose where I started is the macro level. Where are we? Where's the economy? Where's interest rates going? What sectors are hot? What are not? I mean, if you look back, I look back over the years, and at one stage, you know, when all the milk wars were happening, you know, I remember seeing a story in the Financial Review saying milk is the new liquid gold because of baby formula. And I did pretty well out of that time. And then it was the lithium, which I didn't get into. Then it was the cobalt. Then it was the rare earths. There's always a theme going on. And I think Roger Montgomery calls those the concept stocks. And I try and avoid those. If I'm in early, I'll exit. But I won't come in late. I don't suffer from FOMO.
That's very important. It gets a lot of us.
So what I do, I tend to read the AFR two or three times a week. I read a lot of the Reserve Bank of Australia research. It's quite good and independent. A lot of resources there. I go to those ASX days, which are sponsored by NABTRADE, which are unbelievably good value or free if you're with premium, and excellent resources.
So the book you're mentioning there, the ASX Investor Days, they're just coming up. So Adelaide and Perth are shortly. Sydney's not to the end of June.
I'm going to that one, yes.
Yeah, so they're all the way through June. So if you're listening to this and you want to come to the ASX Investor Days, please do. It's a full day. They put on really high quality speakers. And the intention is just to educate people and give people an opportunity to talk to market participants, which we love as well, right?
Yeah, I will just give a plug. The one I went to in April last year, it was a small caps day. It was on a Saturday. Something like $40, you know. It was a very good, and I picked up two stocks there, and both of them more than doubled since then. So it's paid for itself many times over.
Oh, that's a nice way to look at it.
Mm. So going with the research, I tend to monitor the movement in ASX sectors. So I'll look at resources, I'll look at REITs, that sort of thing. Look at it from a top down. So where's the economy going? Which sectors are doing well? Obviously, things like the banks have been through hell this year because of the Royal Commission, and then, you know, housing finance slowing. There's always a theme going on, and they've gone from the bad guys to the good guys in the last week. So there's always an opportunity. There's always something growing and going.
So you're looking for insights from all over the place.
I was going to then also, once, like for example, the example I gave about the car industry. I mean, I've never been interested in the car industry. And I saw the stocks getting lower and lower and lower. And anyone who drives in traffic knows there's a lot of cars around there. So what I did, I picked out the three main operators, which are listed, looked at the figures. So if I pick an industry, which would be the car industry, then I looked at down, I go down to the stock level. I've actually set up, a bit like a bit of a nerd, a spreadsheet to analyze about 200 companies. And what I tend to do is, a bottom-up analysis. So I say, look, it looks scary spreadsheet, but it's great because it helps you compare, you know, price earnings ratios, enterprise values, and all this other technical stuff. It shows dividend yields and it shows, you know, price earnings ratio. And then I can compare companies within the sector. I mean, it's no good comparing, say, Macquarie Bank with Woolies. It's a totally different industry. But once you have a cohort in a particular sector, it makes it easy for analysis, and that's what I do. And I pick that which is the most, usually the cheapest, and shows a bit of value. And I said, in that particular case, you know, there was two companies I liked, and now they're merging, and they've done pretty well. That's APE and AHG. Again, a very unloved sector, and they've done really well.
It's absolutely fascinating the way you speak, because obviously I talk to a lot of fund managers and they will use very similar examples to the ones that you're using in terms of how you do your research. You start top down, then you do your bottom up, you analyse the companies within a sector that you think has opportunity. So I feel like we've heard this story before, but for someone who does it from home, it's incredibly impressive, particularly the way you analyse. So I think your background as a CFO must be incredibly valuable here.
Yeah, well, I've sent this spreadsheet to friends of mine. It's a bit intimidating, but I try and keep it simple, and it makes comparisons very easy. Like there's a lot of moving parts, but if you get it down to, you know, what are you paying for the earnings? Just keep it simple. Which one looks cheaper on the face of it? Then I compare things like debt level, gearing. Some companies look cheaper, but they're cheaper for a reason. They've got too much debt, and too much debt holds them back. Creates, you know, solvency issues, et cetera, et cetera. And after doing it like 10 years full time, you get used to it, you know.
Do you look at qualitative issues like management and so on? You read the Financial Review where there is a lot of, you know, really high quality analysis, but also just commentary on some of the things that go on in various companies and so on. Do you look at that as well?
I do. The only issue I have with some of the in the press is, usually someone's, you know, it's not objective. Like I find I'm becoming, as I get older, a bit cynical. And, you know, if a broker's written a report, they're up to something. Whereas if I go, but if I, you know, like I'll look at the numbers, I'll go through, the numbers are all available. Everything you need is there. And the other thing I mentioned, some of the research is, if, like, for example, I was looking at one particular car company where the numbers didn't make sense, like their loans to stock didn't make sense. And I thought, because they use a lot of what they call floor plan debt. And so I actually sent a shareholder, I do this quite often, and the CFO rang me and explained why there's a difference. So they're very, very, you know, very good at answering the questions.
You might find as an investor you get really high quality info.
Yes, and well, the CFO actually called me and said, this is, you know, he apologised for being a day late. And he said, this is the reason. Things that, and I said, great, thank you, thanks for that. I was going to say, and the other part of the my analysis is I'll do my analysis to see, you know, which one looks cheaper. Then I'll go to see NAB Trade and look at some of the research and get the consensus. And if the consensus price target is higher than, you know, or lower than where it is at the moment, I'll make a decision whether to buy or not. So there's a whole lot of information, but the whole idea behind the research, I feel comfortable in buying the stock. I don't want to go in blind, like, you know, someone at the barbecue says, buy this code. If I don't understand it, I'm happy. And if it goes wrong, I did the research, and then at least I know why it went wrong. So
you've got all of those inputs and they're helping you to make a decision, but there's a really wide variety of inputs. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
So tell me a bit about how you spend your day. Do you look at markets as soon as you wake up? Do you log in straight away? Do you have a cup of coffee? What do you do?
Have you been talking to my wife? Look, the mobile phone is a killer. The first thing I do is look at the futures, unfortunately. Like this morning, I woke up 3:30 a.m. just you know, intermittently, and I looked and the futures were down like 200 points in the US, that is. Look, the futures is the main guide of the day, how things are going. I was expecting, because these days, well, anyway, I'll talk about that later, and really no day is the same. I'll get up, have breakfast, then if my daughter misses the bus, I've got to take her to the station, so that'll disrupt things a bit. But the first thing, the most important thing is between, say, the things I monitor at the start is basically, you know, the futures. I look at the foreign exchange rate, what's happening there, because I believe the Aussie dollar is going down because of interest rate differentials and between Australia and the US. Look at bond yields. And then I try and catch, I watch a bit of Bloomberg TV. I try and watch the close, which is quite interesting. Even though it's not directly related to Australia, you get a lot of the sentiment from there. As you can see, the US is down, we're down. So if you believe it or not, there's a strong correlation between the two markets. Then what I do then is after breakfast, I'll sit down and watch the ASX announcements come through. Most of the important announcements come out between, say, 8:30 and 10 a.m. in the morning. Any takeovers, any adjustments, and that sort of starts the process flowing. I usually only look at the announcements that are more or less on my watch list. So what I'll do is pick out anything that's relevant. For example, there could be this is how the day flows. There could be an update. Some company comes out and says, "Okay, we've downgraded our earnings." It's one that I follow. I go out, update my spreadsheet, get the new figures, and then decide what do I do. We'll talk about that one later. Then by 10 a.m., the shops open, and we'll see how the market opens. Again, I'll review all the winners. And one thing, I'll go through all the gainers and losers, and if there's a stock that I'm interested in, I'm more interested in the losers as a value investor. I don't care what goes up. So, because you make more money from the value trade, so I'll pick some of the losers, and if it's interesting, I'll do some more research on it. Otherwise, I'll do nothing. And that more or less goes for probably about 11 o'clock. And if it's quiet, I'll just see, I'm a keen cyclist and ocean swimmer. And, you know, so what I'll do, I'll go for a 30K ride or a swim or both. And I think something I need to clear up as traders, we just don't sit there in our pyjamas with the leftover pizza from the night before. I think you've got to keep a bit of balance. You've got to do a bit of trading and a bit of exercise. Like a classic example is I had a week surfing holiday with some mates. And so, you know, at lunchtime, New Zealand time, everyone would sit around and check their trading accounts. We're all about similar age. So it's a real lifestyle choice. So it's actually fun. It really is. It's a good, great lifestyle.
Do you feel you belong to a bit of a community of people who do this?
Absolutely, yes.
And did you join this community after you started doing it, or were they people you knew already and you all made the decision collectively?
That's a really good question. And yes, they pick you rather than you pick them. And these are people I know, and again, people in similar age, they've got some money to invest, and I'm like the nerd of the group. So if anybody finds a stock, they say, like, you know, I've got a good example I'll give you later where, you know, someone will say, "What do you think about this stock?" So I say, "Oh, okay, I do the finances," and then I send them the report and say, "Look, I think they've got too much debt, or they're too expensive, or, you know, etc."
So it's obviously quite collegiate. You're not too competitive with each other. You're not.
A little bit.
That's a really cool idea, because some people use chat rooms for that, or they use other ways of communicating. You guys get together physically.
Yeah, I don't use the hot coppers or the, I don't know what the other ones are called, but they're all. Sorry, I call them the crazies. They're the intraday traders. I'm never an intraday trader where you've got to buy at 10 and sell before 4. That's not my. I'm more of an investor than a trader.
We were having a conversation before we started, and Lucio was asking me whether I'm an active trader. I have two small children, and my husband and I travel sporadically, and we've just made a decision. We are not at a stage of our lives where we can trade actively. We're just not across things as well as you are. We're a bit more of the buy and hold at this stage of our lives. I think when we're going to give it a bit more time, hopefully when they're 18, we'll be able to be a bit more attentive. So, what triggers a buy decision for you then? What is it that's going to be the?
I'll give you a recent example. for example, another mate that I sort of trade with, he suggested a stock. Suggested Flight Centre, and this was probably about 6 weeks ago. I think I can't remember. And you know, had a big dip because they came out with a profit downgrade. And again, this is what triggers the buy. This is a very good example. And so the first thing I did is also hang on, because I think I was out shopping, so I said, I'll get back to the price. Sounds good, but I'll do the numbers. So, again, I reviewed the price on Flight Centre, I already had it in my model and the competitors, Webjet and Corporate Travel. Again, I like to look at them within the sector because they're no good looking in isolation. So I did that and they looked really good. And I read the announcement. First thing I do, I always go down the bottom, look at the outlook. And they said, look, you know, the US business is becoming bigger than the Australian business. I thought, well, that's great. And more US dollar earnings. I like this. It's a buying opportunity. So then the next stage, because I'm now an options trader, is I thought, I didn't have spare cash, so how can I get a good exposure with that much cash? So there were options for it. So I went in and bought some call options. That's a right to buy at a certain price. And that was around about $38.66. And today they're trading at like nearly $43. So, and again, because the training wheels are now off on the options, I said, well, okay, I might hold the options out to August. So I get to see the result and decide whether I exercise the options and take the dividend. So that's the trade that I did.
So what was the process you used to get comfortable trading options? How did you, you know, having told us that you went and, you know, did formal study in a whole series of areas in order to become proficient in them, what was it that got you over the line
sure.
with options?
Look, options are, it's a simple concept, but it's like a minefield. again, at the ASX, we're offering options courses, something like $20 for the basic course and $20 for the advanced course. So I did that in one day and it was very useful. Then I signed up with NabTrade. You've got to do a quiz, which means you need to understand. Well, actually, I'll go back. I tried to do the quiz before I did the training and I failed. And so I think regulation-wise, you have to follow the quiz. So I said, okay, I'll do the training. Did the training, killed the quiz. It's too easy. So obviously I needed the training. That's what that tells me. And then they let me loose on options. And, look, it was very interesting. I started, without getting too technical, going too short. And then I realised they're time-based. So then I started to go further out and start mainly calls. And then I started, which is buys, and then did options on the index. So I was doing what they call a put option, so I could short the index, which I did, and which I'm doing at the moment. So the market's down today, but I'm making money. So thank you, options. And you learn the hard way. You do a bad option, it's pretty obvious. Yeah. There's no dividends, nothing. There's a black hole.
So when you're taking puts over the index, is that a protection mechanism for you, or is that that's your plan?
Yes, it is, and I convinced some people in the in the boys club, that the group that invests. I said, well, you might have $1 million in your account at the moment in your portfolio. What can you do to protect that? Nothing. I said, if you take out an option to sell the index, I said, you've protected yourself. And as I said to the people we deal with, I said, you feel stupid putting in the put option until the market drops, and then you look like a genius.
Yeah, you feel really clever. Yeah.
And the thing is, if it doesn't come off, the market goes up, then you win because your portfolio goes up. But there's definitely a correlation. As soon as the market drops, boom, up go the options.
Yeah. So you've got that protection there. That's really it's really good to hear, and interesting that you've decided to take that approach. So on the flip side, what we find with most of our investors, it's certainly a question I get all the time, which is that sell decision is the hardest, particularly if something's done really well for you. But we find it hard to cut our losses, and we find it hard to cut our gains as well. Do you have rules that determine your sells?
Look, that's a good question. I have no problem selling.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll just qualify that. Look, usually, again, if I've made a good return, I don't mind. So I've got no emotional attachment to it. I get upset if it keeps going, but that's another story. And what I've learned from that, I was taking some sales. I'd sell out completely, and then it keeps going. So what I've done lately, learned, is some of those small caps I bought last year that have gone really well, I've sold half. So sell half, keep half. And one of the things that, you know, against the group that we have these chats, because we're all in similar stocks, so we're going to sell. The next question is, what are you going to buy? Normally, what helps me get over the selling is what I'm going to buy next. I'm normally selling something to find a better opportunity. And usually, and the biggest problem you have as a trader, it's, and I call it, which bus do you want? You've got to get on the quickest bus. So That's why you want to sell, because you want a new opportunity. Because if you don't move, you'll never get the new opportunity.
That's a beautiful one. I think I'm going to start using that with people. One of the stories I tell all the time, self-managed super funds hold roughly a quarter of their assets in cash and term deposit, which is vastly higher than they need to for portfolio purposes and often to meet their income needs, and their yield is so low and they're bitterly upset about that poor yield at the moment, obviously. And when we ask why they hold so much in cash and TDs, so there's surveys that go out every year and they've been going out for well over a decade now, the answer is exactly the same every year, which is I'm waiting for a better investment opportunity. But you've chosen your opportunity before you do it.
Look. if you gave me $10 million today, I would spend it in 5 minutes.
Yeah, wow. Still got a dream list all the time.
All the time. And you know, it's almost frustrating that you can't. And that's the biggest frustration is, like, I've got some gains, as I said before, that I bought during the big dip in December. And for tax reasons, I'm sort of in handcuffs. I want to sell those in July. So if I could sell them now, I'd crystallise the gains and get punished. But I've got lots to buy. But, so the biggest struggle is, you know.
Money to buy all the things you want.
Exactly.
that's fantastic. And that's so many people are struggling to find value in this market. So the fact you're finding so much value is exciting.
Yeah. Well, look, you just got to look hard. That's all.
Do the work. So you need the big spreadsheet.
Again, the advantage of options, if the market's overpriced, then short the market. All I can do today. So that's going up. So
it's helping.
So the market's going down, the options going up.
Yeah. So do you benchmark your returns? I'm aware that you're as an individual, your needs are not the same as just getting the market return, right? Like, you've got to provide an income for your family. There's many things you need to do with it. But do you benchmark?
No. Again, as I said, the theme is I need absolute returns. So I need, and that's a good question, because I'm looking for absolute after-tax returns. I mean, I could take all my gains now that are unrealised and beat the benchmark and feel great, but then I'll give half to the tax office. And so, you know, I'm pretty hard on myself, and that means my after-tax returns would be lower. So if I, you know, delay the gains till next year, I've already set up, you know, 25-30% next year's income. And, like, for example, those Macquarie dividends and some other dividends are all going to next year. So that's, you know, I've already done maybe 40-50% of my target for next year, which is great. I don't have to worry about it. Then I can worry about the next year. So I tend to plan financial year to financial year. That's the way I operate.
That point about absolute after-tax returns is excellent. It's one of the biggest criticisms of the investment industry as an industry is you are benchmarking to the average of everybody else's performance. Frankly, if you did minus 23% versus a benchmark of minus 29%, I still had a terrible year. You've done really well. I think I've done dreadfully.
Exactly. Exactly. Minus 23 does nothing for me. Now, I'll just also, again, when I trade, I'm holding some shares longer, some shorter, trading options, for example, some over 2 or 3 days, just opportunistic trades. Now, they're all taxable, so what I'm doing is I've got a mix of capital gains and a mix of franking credits coming in from some stocks. So the objective, which is hard to balance, but I get there, is to, you know, get the franking credits to pay for the gains. So the tax is paid by the franking credits. That's utopia.
That's the principle. Mm. It's so how do you maintain your discipline? Because you've got quite a complex series of decisions going on at all times, right? That's a complex portfolio by most people's standards. In fact, it's quite complex by most fund manager standards as well. Professionals have less complex portfolios than yours. How do you maintain your discipline?
Just stick to the numbers, I suppose. As I said, I strictly follow the numbers. Mm. I try not to get too emotional about it. The fact that, you know, at the moment I've probably got, you know, too many financials, it doesn't bother me. Like, if you looked at the modern a modern portfolio theory, I'd look terrible, but it's making returns, so I'm happy, and I can bear that. You know,
as they say, the market can stay rational a lot longer than you can stay solvent, right? Yeah, a lot of the theory is great, but it's what happens in reality that pays the bills.
I think the key is never be a forced seller. Like, And something I haven't mentioned is cash flow, because, you know, at the moment I'm almost fully invested. So I try and time, you know, the dividends to more or less cover the living costs. when the visa bill comes in, I've got dividends coming in. So it's, you know, there's the cash flow management is pretty, other than the tax, is probably one of the most important things, because you don't want to be a forced seller.
That is, you're absolutely correct. That's the worst case scenario, right? Mm. So are there any things that you'll think about doing differently in the future? Any macro events on the horizon that you're concerned about? Any major themes that you'd like to be part of?
Well, that's a good question. I thought about that when you posed that question. Again, I look at the current thematic in the market. And to me, in the medium term, as I said, you've got record low Australian bond yields, which means if they're right, that means real estate trusts and any bond-type proxies are overpriced, so I won't go there. It makes all high dividend stocks look good, like the banks look cheap on a valuation basis. The low Australian dollar, again, that's very good for foreign earnings companies, which I've got a number of those, like Macquarie Bank, and they said the ag stocks are doing fairly well. That's the element about the ag stocks. I bought some of the ag, suppliers, like, you know, Elders, and because of the drought, they've been in a hole, and so I picked them up quite reasonable, and now one's actually under a takeover bid, Rural Holdings. Again, the value proposition always wins in my book. And also, we've got lower domestic growth. I think there'll be very low growth. So, personally, I wouldn't touch retailers at this stage. They don't look cheap.
So, your point about being a value investor, you're not just going for cheap. There's a real quality theme there too.
Yes, yes. Oh, the other thing I was going to mention again, when I was reading your questions, is that looking back this year, I'd say probably 80% of my returns are on capital gains, which is, you know, we went from a big dip in December to a rise. So, and the dividends are probably 20%. But I would say, again, my guess going forward is dividends will be probably make up a bigger part of the return. Like the index got to 6.5, which is pretty high. I think it's about 11-year high. I can't see it going much higher. So I think the returns are going to be more dividend-based rather than PE expansion. Although with the low bond yields, as they are, who knows? I mean, if you compare CBA yield or any of the banks' yield with the bond yields, it's a no-brainer. But does that mean people are going to pay too much for it? So it's, again, back to the value proposition. As I said, well, I do a lot of research. I spend a lot of time doing it, probably too much time. Look, I watch a lot of Bloomberg, and those guys go on, analyse everything to death. It's interesting. It doesn't directly apply to Australia, but it's interesting what they do. They do a lot of, they analyse everything. Like it's, they just analyse things to death.
So one question without notice, is there any individual whose thoughts that you follow? Is there anyone who, when they say something, you really pay attention?
My wife.
Answer of the day. That's beautiful. No, some people will follow anything Buffett has to say, for example, or you know, any of those sorts of examples. Doesn't matter if you
look.
Don't.
No. I like Roger Montgomery. I like the way he thinks, and he sort of follows the Buffett model, but doesn't always work. I think what people, again, what I do, for example, people, everyone talks about Buffett. Buffett, you know, when everyone's greedy, be fearful, when everyone's fearful. Everyone talks about it around the barbecue. Now, in December when we had the big, the big drop, no one's buying. Like I remember I was buying Apple shares in the morning and a mate of mine sent me a text. He said, you know, a bit of schadenfreude, said, there's no love for Apple. So I just bought some, $142. And then, 2 weeks ago they were $210. So, you know, you feel a bit silly buying at that moment, but when you look back, it's the right thing to do. So everyone talks a Buffett way, but doesn't act, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I like the Buffett technology, but no one follows. You know? But even Buffett, again, he made some comments, I think, 2 weeks ago that now he wishes he bought Amazon. Now that's, he's getting a bit of FOMO now, I think.
It's a worry when Buffett's getting FOMO.
Yes.
That's a real worry.
And I think you need, and FOMO's a problem because, as I said, you had all the Fed, you had the marijuana stocks, you had the milk stocks, and I had one particular stock that, it was like a biotech, and then all of a sudden, guess what? They're into marijuana. And all of a sudden, the price just jumped up 300%. I was out. The chairman was out. And now they're in suspension. So if I'm early on one of those concept stocks, I'm out. Yeah.
We saw some very similar things with Bitcoin. If you recall, there were plenty of things that were rebranding themselves, blockchainbitcoin.com or something or other.
Exactly.
And watching the prices spike accordingly.
But again, the criticism I have that people say it's a good stock, it's going up. Because it's going up. Doesn't make any money.
Until it doesn't. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So to me, it's the earnings. Like, I did pretty well out of Afterpay. Everyone's talking about Afterpay. But, the $6, $7 billion company don't make money. Do your own research,
Lucio, thank you so much for your time today. I can't tell you how grateful we are for your insights and your thoughts. You've been so generous. I think the only thing I'm afraid of is that people are going to listen and go, there's no way I'm going to go and get a degree in accounting technology and become a CFO before I'm about to start trading. That's too much. But it's incredibly powerful for people to hear what someone does with their own portfolio, how they trade it, the discipline that you've got and the rigor you put into your research, I think is really, it's powerful for people to hear that. It's not something that we hear every day. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Jenna.
And as always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you. If you are a trader and you want to share with us how you do things, we'd love to know. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.